Morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming. We still have people coming. I guess people are moseying slowly, so I'll get started, and we'll see how it goes. Let me introduce myself. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Charles. Let me do a little bit about my family. These women are the loves of my life. That's Serena. She's an English teacher. We've been married for 20 years. Met her at Berkeley. She's kind of a typical, if you see her in a room, she's kind of a typical Asian woman. She kind of is quiet. But if you get to know her, she has a kind of a sharp, acerbic wit that she kind of reserves for me. It's a privilege, I assure you. That's Kirsten, my oldest, and that's Nikki. She's going to high school in the fall. She's going to middle school this fall. They're just going fast. They're wonderful. I consider myself one of the luckiest father out there. They well behaved. They're kind. They read books like crazy, and they work hard in school. I'm a little worried, you know, because they're going to high school, and I'm just a little nervous about this whole thing. So that's where I am. A bit more about myself. This is InterVarsity, so I stuck that first line up there. INTP, Enneagram number 9, one wing, for those of you who know. And I'm sure I just told you tons about me, right? For those of you who are like into this Enneagram, Myers-Briggs thing, you got me completely pegged right into that box. Like, this is Charles right there. Okay, so great. For those of you who are not as into that, immigrated from Taiwan at age 10, which puts me at 1.5. I have all kinds of issues about growing up and dealing with being kind of a bicultural person. I went to Berkeley, studied electrical engineering and computer science. The department name acronym forms EECS, which is really kind of them to make it, you know, to make it easier to make fun of us who are geeks. Let's make it work. Study four-year regent, and then did my PhD of Hebrew and Semitics at UW-Madison, did my dissertation on the Book of Job. I spent 14 years there, which makes me an excellent speaker for the Ivy Grad Fellowship. I'm a tremendous source of encouragement to all the students. You know, at least you haven't been here as long as Charles was here. I am the standard for academic futility at UW right now. It's good. There are reasons why I took 14 years, but it's a long story. We don't have to get into that. And then I've been a campus theologian at UW-Madison for the past 4 years. So that's kind of a bit about me. I'm sure some of you might have some questions about my theological background. So Chinese American Church, I really came of faith in PCUSA at First Press at Berkeley. Undergrad in a varsity, and I went to Regent College, and where I met my mentor, Bruce Waltke, and I had the tremendous privilege of working on this book with him and co-authored this book with him. Much of what you will hear today either directly comes out of this book or are derived from it, comes out of the thinking. It's funny, I teach a lot, and then you know, a couple of years ago, I went down to see Bruce to give a talk at in Wisconsin. And he was saying things, and I thought, wait, that's exactly what I said. I thought, okay, either he got it from me, or I just completely internalized what he was doing, and I thought it was mine now. It's really weird how plagiarism works. So anyway, so a lot, I'm not going to channel Bruce Waltke, except to say that I don't claim to be original. Okay, which is a good thing for a biblical scholar. Okay, I don't claim to be original. It's a good thing. Okay, so Let me kind of situate us. You read this statement yesterday. It's on the Multi-Ethnic Ministries website. The dream and put in practice that God's people, all of God's people, are welcome and cherished in God's kingdom. It is the hope and vision of a community of Christ followers that represent the diversity of God's creation. And then you've heard this one invoked multiple times, Revelation 7 and 9. And if you want to look at biblical passages that talk about multi-ethnicity, go on the Multi-Ethnic Ministry website. I commend that to you. It has a lot of stuff. On the section that says Biblical Commitments, has a lot of passages. Excellent stuff. So if you want to kind of get a feel for what's all in the Bible about multi-ethnicity, go there. What I don't want to do is repeat that here for you. What I want to answer the question is slightly different. The question I want to answer is this. While we all know this, while we all know that multi-ethnicity is an important concept in the Bible, it shows up. How important is it? I mean, we just spent, you know, the entire National Staff Conference here talking about this. The Bible talks about a lot of different stuff. Okay? We don't spend a whole conference talking about those things. Right? So, it's in the Bible, yes. How important is it? Is it core? Is it central? I think people have that question about, you know, about this. We have a task force going on that's ongoing. We're transforming the way we do our ministry, the way we recruit, we train, the way we retain. We're doing some serious rethinking about all of this. So it'd be nice to know how this fits into the big story. Okay. So is it important? Is it core to what we believe about God and His people? And how do we decide that? The secondary question for a person like me would be asking, what role does the theme of multi-ethnicity play in the story arc of the Bible? Okay? That's how I assess the question. How important is it? Well, it shows up. I don't count texts. It's not like, oh, it shows up 15 verses, therefore, or 15 different passages, therefore it ranks higher than the one that shows up 10. But rather, what role does it play in the larger storyline? Okay? So that's what we're trying to do today. I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I gave a series of three talks last summer at the Midwest Regional Conference. And this one's going to, you know, and it wasn't enough time back then. So we're going to squeeze down to 1 hour. It's going to work much better. So see how it goes. So I will have to be kind of rigorous, and please help me through this. If you have a question that's for clarification, by all means ask it immediately, because I don't want to lose you. If I made a leap in logic that wasn't clear, if I said something you didn't know what I mean by that, jump right in and ask me, I'll clarify. But if it's a different kind of question, it's more something more speculative, more like let's talk, give and take kind of thing, let's say that to the end. Is that okay? All right, and so I have a tendency to forget that, so if somebody of you in front can like help me enforce, that would be good. Okay, good.
I'll monitor that.
Good, you know, just whack them on the head or something. Okay. Okay. That's nice. If we're talking about the biblical narrative, we want to look at the Bible as a whole. You know, you can all, it's really about how high you go in terms of, you know, if you want to look at the plane, the book, Bible as a whole, and versus how much detail you can get. So this is a view of the Bible in five acts. Act 1, God creates heaven and earth and appoints human vice regents to rule the earth on his behalf. That's pretty much Genesis 1 and 2. The human vice regents rebel against their liege, leading to chaos and corruption on earth. That's chapter 3 through 11 of Genesis. And then God calls into existence the kingdom of Israel as his tool to end rebellion and restore his rule on earth, but the kingdom joins the rebellion. That's pretty much the rest of the Old Testament. Okay. Act 4, God sends his son as the embodiment of faithful Israel and calls the church into existence as his tool to end rebellion and restore his rule on earth. And that's the New Testament. That's where we live today in Act 4. And Act 5, God restores his rule on earth and renews all creation. That's the act that we're looking for, we're hoping for, and praying for. So that's kind of the big picture, the storyline that we're going for. And you can tell already that there's it's important what we call junctures in these acts. Okay, passages that you shift from one to the other, I consider important. That makes Genesis 3 very critical, the beginning of Act 2. Genesis 12 pretty critical, beginning of Act 3. Okay. And, of course, the New Testament. If we dive in and get a little more detail on the Old Testament, I want to introduce you to the idea of primary history. You probably heard this before, but if you haven't, biblical scholars are pretty much in consensus at this point that there is a unified text, sometime done in the exile, that combines Genesis all the way through Kings. Somebody tied it all together, knitted it together as one single story. So when you read the book of Genesis, you go, oh, this flows nicely to Exodus. And flow all the Leviticus, you know, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and it just keeps on going all the way to Kings. By the way, we've dropped out Ruth. Ruth doesn't fit into the storyline. Okay. So this is one single book. It fits very nicely. It's a single narrative. And when we start thinking about Old Testament theology, one of the ways to think about this is that this is a skeleton of the Old Testament, in which other works, other blocks of literature, such as prophetic literature, hymnic literature, wisdom literature, apocalyptic literature, they hang on the skeleton like muscles, like organs. So in other words, you need to know this structure to understand all the other books, more or less. I mean, there's a couple of books you can get away with not knowing. But if you want to read Isaiah and not know the primary history, it doesn't work. Right? If you want to read Esther and not know primary history, it doesn't work. You don't know what's going on. So this primary history setting up the context for reading everything else. Okay. So I'm going to... So now within primary history, by the way, another warning, when I stand and walk and talk, I sweat a lot. I'm not having a heart attack. Relax. I try to keep the room as cool as possible. So, okay. This is primary history in detail. There's Genesis 1 through 11. That's the primeval history and lays out the basic problem. And then we have the second half, Genesis 12 to the end of Kings. In primary history, it's divided into two sections. Okay, one, the basic problem of the world, and then God's solution to the problem. And I say solution because it wasn't much of one. The history of the kingdom of Israel and God's solution to the problem. Okay. So that's your split right there. Okay, and if we're looking at history, we're looking at story arc. Today, I want to focus on two passages in the biblical story arc that are pivotal. And when I mean pivotal, I don't mean important. I mean they are the pivots of the story. That would be Genesis 11 and Genesis 12. Okay. This is the turning point of the Bible. Okay. Everything shifts here. Everything changes. We're talking about the problem of the world and then like shifting into the story of God's people. Even the New Testament, I wouldn't call it a pivot, because it's a continuity. It's a continuation of the people of God. Right? It's changing forms. Okay, so the pivotal passages, Genesis 11 and Genesis 12. I want to go in there. Okay. Any questions so far?
No.
Okay. Thanks. Yes. Thanks. No, that's good. That's good. Okay. So we're all clear on this. So. A quick summary of primeval history, Genesis 1 through 11, to kind of get to where we are. You have God the Emperor creating heaven and earth. You have installing humans as rulers of the earth in 1 and 2. And then you have the rebellion and expulsion. And then we have the King Abel story. We have King commits fratricide and Lamech boasts of violent retaliation. And those two tales frame the development of human culture, which is a very interesting way of critiquing the development of human culture. You have two stories of violence framing that. We have God preserving a single godly line from Seth in Genesis 5. And 6 through 10, God rescues humanity and creation from the corruption of sin and blesses the formation of many nations. I would like to spend more time talking about the blessing of the many nations, but we don't have time. That's one of the things I had to cut. So if you have questions about it at the end, we can come back and talk to me about it. There's a sense of escalation of rebellion here. We have murder, we have violent retaliation, and then we have utter corruption so that we have the flood come through, and then we end with the Tower of Babylon story. In this simple way of viewing this, you see that Tower of Babylon is the culmination, the final point, the highest point, the apogee of human rebellion. Okay, but what the heck is it? What is going on? So that's why I want to spend some time on this one. Here's the passage. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. Yahweh said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So Yahweh scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it's called Babel, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole world. From there Yahweh scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Okay, a couple things to note. First of all, you'll notice I titled the section "The Tower of Babylon." Okay, you probably picked that up like, wait, that sounds a little odd. That's because we're pretty certain that this place is talking about Babylon. The story's talking about Babylon. We're almost 100% certain it's talking about Babylon. First of all, the plain of Shinar refers to the region of South Mesopotamia. It's kind of like where the Babylon is the major city. It'd be like in the plain of I don't know, Dane County? I don't know. Like, then you can, we're talking about Madison, maybe, pretty much, right? You're talking about, you know, the Southern California L.A. Basin. We're talking about L.A., which we're talking about the area around it. Okay, that's one. And second, they tell you the city's called Babel, which is kind of frustrating for people like me, because the word Babel, if you look at the biblical Hebrew, Babel, means Babel, Babylon. It's, let me back it up. Everywhere else, Babel, except in Genesis, and here, and the one prior, English translators translate Babel as Babylon. There simply is not a different word. But for some reason, the English translator decided, we're going to transliterate and go with Babel, Babel, and not go with Babylon. Here's the thing. The original readers of this, if you want to go with ancient Israelites in the wilderness, if you want to go with the completed work in Babylon itself, when they run across this passage that says Babel, they're thinking Babylon. They're not thinking anything else. Okay? There's just no getting around this. This is about Babylon. The etymology of the word, Akkadian, Babylon, comes out of the word Bav Elu, which means gate of the god. So Elu, El, God, Bav is gate. And you can see kind of a nice picture here. I don't have time to get into that. So why was it called Babylon? Because the Yahweh, Balal, the language of the world. So that's the pun. I know that sometimes you hear a lot of people talking about Babel meaning to confuse. Actually, it doesn't, but Balal does. So there's kind of the, you know, it's called Babel because God Balal. That's kind of a near thing going on there. Okay. Any questions on that? Yes?
So the timeline, even ancient Israel wandering in the desert, yeah. Babylon already
existed long before. Long before. Okay, so that's a very good point, a very, very important point to make about
the Mesopotamian civilization. Babylon's been in existence. We have records going back as far back as 2900.
Now, if you're going to go with the oldest date of Exodus, 1500, that's 1400. That's over a millennium, 1.5 millennium. We're talking about one of the most important civilizations in terms of culture. I don't want to go through the details there for you. But the cultural achievements, the great epic poetry of Atrahasis, Gilgamesh, flood stories, creation myths, Enuma Elish, they are a deeply, deeply religious people. Deeply religious people. They focus on heavily studying of divination, figuring out what does God have in mind? They study the stars. I mean, they were the first astronomers, or astrologers, I guess we would call it. And they had very systematic religion with organized cults. Big buildings, architecture devoted to the gods, massive parades and festivals. This was a religious culture. Okay. The point you were making already, I think it's important, is that by the time Israel came out of Egypt, we're talking about a major cultural phenomenon to the east. They're leaving Egypt, which is the other one, and they're heading toward Canaan, which lies between the two civilizations. Okay. Canaan is nothing. There's nothing really. I mean, there's things going on there, but the big, big ones are over here. This is the major center, and already they are. You have a history to talk about. You have a literature to address. You have to actually confront Babylonian worldview and religion. Okay. If so, then the Tower of Babylon story, is a critique of lower Mesopotamian culture. Right? So what is the critique? First of all,
I want to point out verse 3. They said to each other, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They use brick instead of stone, all that kind of stuff. The verse is talking about this people, and they're really into the fact that they have bricks. And they're pretty excited about it. Okay? Now, why are we talking about this?
Well, it's not just that the biblical author cares about this, is that the Babylonians themselves think this is a really big deal. And the biblical author is kind of making fun of them for it. Okay? So, if you take a look, the building inscriptions repeatedly mention the use of bricks in Mesopotamia. If you look at the Epic of Enuma Elish, they're talking about building Babylon at this point. Let's build a shrine whose name should be called... let's skip down.
construct Babylon, whose building you have requested. Let its brickwork be fashioned. You shall name it the sanctuary. And Anunnaki applied the implement. For one whole year, they molded bricks. They spent a whole year molding bricks. That's a lot of bricks, right? And the second year arrived, they raised high the head of Askalia as equaling Apsu, having built a stage tower as high as Apsu. Okay. They set it up in an abode for Marduk, Enlil, and Ea. And in the presence, he was seated in grandeur. So you understand, just from this passage, you get religious practices, you know, some part of it. Tower going up, what's up there? The homes of the gods. Right, we're building homes of the gods in these towers. So, and they really cared about their bricks. Here's another example. This is actually found on this particular stone. You can't really see it very well. Apparently they can get that out of this. Amazing. Okay. But this is inscribed on one of the ziggurats, one of the towers. Etmenenki, Ziggurat Babili, the house, the foundation of heaven and earth, ziggurat in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, am I, the base I filled in to make a high terrace. I built their structures with bitumen and baked brick throughout. I completed it, raising its top to the heaven, making it gleam bright as the sun. Are you hearing echoes? This is right out of Genesis 11, right? The Genesis 11 people are not constructing this story, kind of, you know, ex nihilo. They're using Babylonian propaganda about their own religious architecture, and they're sticking it right in the story. Okay, so that you really can't mistake it. This is all about Babylonian architecture. By the way, this is just some pictures of Etmenenki. We think it's here. The ziggurat's completely destroyed. We think that was an older one here, and then the Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt it, and then now it's completely wiped out. It's a fairly large size, 300 feet square on the on the foundations, and maybe 300 feet tall. Which is what, 10 stories?
30
stories. 30 stories tall. Okay. If you want to know what one of these look like, we have one in Ur. And you can kind of get a, this is the aerial view, because this is in existence. So you can go visit if you get a chance. And so you have the stairways climbing up that way, and then on top, the temple has been destroyed. So there was something on top of the foundation. This would be the front view. Okay. And here you get the idea that this is a stairway to heaven. Right? You're like, I'm just going to climb straight up, and God's up there. Okay. It's definitely a religious building, and this is a reconstruction. We think it might look something like this. Or at least that guy did, anyway. yeah, somebody thinks that's what it looks like. Okay, so we're missing quite a few multiple levels of increasing level of sacredness all the way to where the gods are. Okay, so... So I think the biblical consensus, the scholar's consensus, is right that this is about Babylonian ziggurats. They're talking about their religious towers. Okay. So, what exactly are they doing? Let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. Why is God upset with this? Okay. That's kind of the question here. If it's a religious building, they're worshiping their gods. Why is God mad? Now, there are people who provide different arguments. And on this question, there are a lot of different responses. One of them is something about, you know, hubris. We can build a tower to reach the heavens. Other people say it's more than that. It's actually an invasion of the heavens, kind of a titanic struggle against God, and we're going to go up, build a heaven, and go up there and fight against them. I find both of those arguments, or any kind of a hubris or invasion idea problematic, because it's odd, because the Babylonians themselves never talk about this. They don't talk about invading the heavens. They're building an abode for God. It's very respectful. Okay, so if you want to critique them, you should at least, there should be some truth to the critique, right? There should be some truth to it. So my reading of this, and I'm not alone in this, is that the critique is really in the next line. Here's the critique. This is a religious people, and they're building, spending all this money and energy building a religious architecture for the sole purpose of making a name for themselves. Religion is in the service of human aspirations. Why do they want to make a name for themselves? Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. So, The critique here is that they're building a tower to reach the heavens, not to talk to God, but to get a sense of divine sanction for their empire. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right? Thank you. Right? God bless Babylon. How do we know God bless Babylon? Right there. Look at that tower. Okay? God's lived right up there. And God's living with us right here in Babylon. We're the most divine. We're the most sacred. We're the most right. We are destiny for the whole world. Therefore, as we conquer the rest of the Middle East, as we go fight the great battles, we have God on our side. Okay? There you go. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly the point. You know, in God we trust. Okay? You put out the money. Okay? In God we trust. We want to spread. We want to establish. We want to make everybody like ourselves. Right? We make the ourselves. We don't want to be scattered. We want to unify. And how do we get sanctioned for that? God's behind us. Okay. So, now I think that's true for almost all empires, right? So that's not surprising. And it was not surprising that that Moses would make this critique in the exile. But think Moses, from Moses' perspective, they're heading toward Canaan, and there is Babylon over there. The old Babylonian empire is over there. They're big and they're strong, and we need to say something about them. Okay? We already said something about the sun god in Genesis 1. The sun god's no good. We already nailed them. We need to say something about the Babylonian empire. We need to say something about their impulse to use religion, to subsume the religious impulse for human purposes. Okay? We need to say something about that. Yes?
So Moses is the redactor?
I'm giving you two perspectives. If we're saying Moses wrote this in the wilderness, I would argue that in the Pentateuch there's a strong Mosaic core. I just don't know where. Okay, so if Moses did this part, then that's the intention. If we're talking about the exile, then you get it even more. I mean, I would say it's much more powerful if you read this and you're sitting in Babylon, and you're watching these towers, and you're seeing these processions, and the critique is, they're just doing it for themselves. They're taking the religious impulse and they're using it to create this massive empire that's conquering and destroying everywhere it goes and wiping out other cultures because God is on our side. And so the critique is much more trenchant, much more visceral when you're sitting in Babylon as a Jew going, yeah, but. Okay. So there's a critique here. Okay. Oh, that clear? Okay. So, what does God think about this? Yahweh came down to see the city and the tower that people were building, and Yahweh said, by the way, I want to note that they built a stairway to the heavens, and God came down. I love that. The word Yarad, it just means going down. But think about it, you have a stairway, so he's just like, okay, you wanted me here, here I am. Okay, the point is they didn't actually want him there. Okay, they didn't actually, go ahead, John.
Were you going to say something about brick versus stone? Why is that important?
Because it's much easier to build with bricks. The bricks are uniform in size. Stonework is difficult, the stacking of stones. So for them, the building brick was a new technology. The baking of bricks and creation, I mean, you saw the pictures, right? How many bricks they had in them. They can build much taller, much more structurally sound buildings with bricks than they would with stones. So it's a big deal for them. They liked it. They're happy. Okay. So there's a kind of critique of technology, reliance on technology in this story as well. God came down. So a bit of jumping ahead. I think sometimes we pray for God to show up, and but really what we're saying, we pray for God to show up, and then we want to do what we want to do. Sometimes God actually shows up. Okay, so that's just a thought on this passage. God shows up here, and his assessment is interesting. He says, there's a problem with them being one people. Okay? There's a problem with them being one people. That human rebellion somehow involves the human tendency for uniformity. And if that uniformity can then co-opt religious impulse, it will then really destroy the one last thing that holds, put boundaries on people's behavior. Before I get into that, let me look at this final line, and I want to clarify my translation. It's not my translation. Many of the English translations go with nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Okay, which is one of the weird verses in the Bible, because why would their ability to build a temple allow them to become omnipotent? And that's just weird. That's just a weird concept. And the Hebrew allows for this translation, but it also allows for this one, because the word to be impossible, lo ibatzer, means to no longer guarded, no longer limited. You can apply it to the planning, or you can apply it to what they do. So it's really, where do you apply that no limit? And I think a better reading is, there's no limit to what they will plan to do. The planning part is what it's unlimited now. Once they become unified, once they have divine sanction, they will do anything they want. The religious impulse, the last thing that holds people back, the fear of some unknown God who gives you conscience, that gets destroyed, because like God is now telling you to invade other countries and destroy their culture and their civilization. And we've seen that. There is no longer any limit, because religion and God has been co-opted. And in this way, this is the culminating rebellion in the primeval history. Individual sins one thing, but now societally, structurally, sin is now thoroughly embedded in a co-opted religion, via co-opted religion. Okay. So, I think I got this quote somewhere. Cultural hegemony matched with divine sanction brooks no resistance, recognize no limits.
Where is that from?
I don't know. I might have written it. I have no idea. it's like that's a nice quote there. Where did it come from? No. Cultural hegemony matched with divine sanction brooks no resistance, recognizes no limits. Okay. So what we have here then is a situation where the one people in uniformity, and that is now a problem, and God needs to do something, and this situation cannot stay, because it is now no longer, there's no recovery possible in a world that's all the same, ruled by one nation, one culture that is using God for its purposes. So God is going to do something. He's going to create a space in which redemption is possible. So he splits them up. Now, I want to know something for you. People talk about God dividing the people. He actually doesn't do that. And I think this is a critical thing to learn, to recognize in this passage. God doesn't divide anybody. He simply changes their language, which is not the same thing. Implicit in here, which I think we all get, is the moment you take away what's the same about people, they separate. Okay. That's what the storyline is telling you. That human unity is based on uniformity. If you take away the thing, the commonality, they will split apart. They will organize themselves into smaller groups that are more similar. And they will fight against the other ones. Okay. Now, that warring faction, that dividing in some ways serves God's purposes, because it creates space for God's kingdom to come in the chapter 12. But here, it is a tremendous critique. God doesn't have to divide them. God just made them different. Go for it. You figure it out. Right? And they just spread out. Okay. And frankly, this is where we are today. Okay. Nothing's really changed. Genesis 11 is the world as it is today, where we divide ourselves on ethnic lines, religious lines, political lines, where the United States is in the massive, massive process of sorting itself based on its political and socioeconomic lines. So everybody in our community now looking more and more similar to ourselves. We don't want to live with people who look different from us and who think differently from us. This sorting is still happening. This is the world today. Yes?
So when it says in 8 and so the Lord scattered them, and
yeah,
there the Lord scattered them. You're saying that maybe that's just He
intended the result. There. Without a doubt, He wanted to scatter them.
Yeah.
But the way he did it is by changing their language, which tells you that he didn't physically drive them out. He let them do it themselves. Okay? Which gets back at something which I don't have time to get into as much as I did at last summer, which is this. There's something about humanity. Our love is for what is similar. We love naturally people who are similar to us, and we have a hard time with differences. Okay? And God is basically playing off that. It's like, that's what they are, that's how they do it. Yes?
Charles, how would you fit this into, maybe this is a question for later,
yeah.
But how would you fit this into the command that God gives to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, and
yes.
Say, let's not do that?
Yes, I would say this is in a continuation of that. God intended for them to scatter, but they don't. God intended them to scatter and develop differently, and they stay together and want to unify everything and become conformed to each other. Yes.
I felt like you made a leap from different, like you said, this is where we are today.
Yeah.
You made a leap from different languages and couldn't communicate to look different.
Right. You're right. That is a leap. I want to argue that God's basic principle in scattering them is to say, I will make them different. And I will say, I'm generalizing. You're right. He made them different languages. They couldn't communicate, but they could. You know, today we do it. They could easily slow down and said, let's learn each other's languages. We could have gone translators and figure things out, but they didn't. Right? Once you took away the thing that unified them, they scattered. So you're right. I am generalizing here. I'm saying that they're not the same,
they're
necessarily.
Not the same,
they're not the same.
In a lot of places, it is the language that's different that causes the friction.
Yes. So I would say the language. I would say a language difference. But I would generalize to say that the language difference is emblematic of humans and the way we organize ourselves. We organize by language, yes, but we also organize other ways. And I think that part is implicitly in here that we like uniformity. We're one people. And when we are different, we don't get along well. But you're right. Okay.
I'm just thinking historically, this notion of confusing their language, I'm curious, is there any evidence as to why they picked that motif?
Uh-huh.
To kind of make this point, just historically in Babylon where does that idea come from?
It's a good question. Not much on that,
okay.
Information-wise. We don't have enough. There's some, today, you know, there's guesses about sources of language, even the kind of the Ur language idea. There's one original language from which all languages derive. It's just hard. Once you get past writing, once we don't have writing anymore, it's just become speculative. We have nothing from further back. Okay. So good. It's a good place to stop because we're finishing with that first passage. Let's move forward. So we're looking at Genesis 12 now. Let me keep going. So, my summary of Tower of Babylon. Humans co-opt religion in the service of a unified society focused on the glory of human achievement. God diffuses rebellion via the splintering of humans into warring language groups, thereby establishing the backdrop for his definitive response. This is the culmination of primeval history. This is the beginning, starting point of the rest of the Bible. And I mean the rest of the Bible, including New Testament. It's all right here. This is the starting point. This is the programmatic lay of the land of what the New Testament is about, the whole rest of the Bible is about. Yahweh said to Abram, go from your country, your people, your father's house, to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Okay. And just a couple comments on the details. There is a leaving behind. Right. Abram's called out of, Ur, Mesopotamia, out of that area, come out and create a new nation. So there's a sense of a separation of the old clan connections to the land, to people, to culture, to religion, and to create a brand new thing. Where the blessing of the nations will come from something outside, from a brand new enterprise. God is now doing nation building. He's going to create a nation out of one single person. Okay. So God's going to do something brand new. You can tell this calling is critical if the point is to make a great nation. Okay. I will also make your name great, which is right out of Genesis 11. They're trying to make their own name great and stay together. And God says, no, I'm going to make Abraham's name great. So there's self attempt to establish a name of fame and reputation, and there's God's giving Abram everything that they were seeking in Tower of Babylon. And then, of course, a heavy emphasis on the word blessing. I will bless you. You will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and then all the earth will be blessed through you. This blessing word comes echoing Genesis 3, the curses in Genesis 3. I think the idea here is very clear. This is to be reversal of the Abrahamic curse. Not Abrahamic, no, Adamic curse. The curse on Adam and Eve, the curse on the land. This is the reversal. Okay, this is God's salvation of the world. It's going to be through a people. Okay, how is that going to work? Well, it seems like this. You're going to come into a place, and you're going to become a great nation, and this nation will sit in front of all the peoples of the earth, and they will respond to you. Okay? And those who bless you, those who go, you are a great nation, God will say, hey, these people recognize me and my character. Come right in. I will bless you. I will restore the relationship. I will change things up. I will reverse the curse. And those people who curse you, the people will see this people and says, I don't like this. They will be cursed. They will be rejected. They will remain outside of God's blessing, God's kingdom. And in this process, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Okay. So, the role of the kingdom, I think, implicitly, is to be kind of a litmus test. You put it right in the middle of the great nations, and then they get to interact with Israel and see how it goes. Right? That's the function. That's the function. This is God's plan to redeem the world. Create a people, put them there, and have other people react with it, interact with it. Okay. I have a lot of visiting scholars from China that ask me this question. Why didn't God go to China? That's just how the guy goes. They always ask that question. And my answer is, have you looked at geography? Okay. Pacific Ocean, Siberia, the deserts, mountain, and then jungles. Okay? If the gospel went to China, nobody else would ever find out about it. Okay? It just won't happen. Which explains Chinese history. It's geographical isolation is amazing. Now, Israel is plopped right down in the middle of that land bridge between three centers of civilization: the Mesopotamian, the Egyptian, and the Greeks. Which, of course, it is the highway of the empires, which is kind of a bummer place to be. But it is also the place where culture, interaction spreads. And if you want to put a nation as kind of this is God's nation, I'm going to put it right there so other people to interact with it and see it. Well, that's the best place for it in the world. And I would just jump ahead and say, the function of the church has not changed. It works exactly the same way. God fundamentally did not change his plan. The church today exists as God's kingdom, and other people see it and go, that's awesome. And they are blessed. And people say, that doesn't work, and they're cursed. Which is kind of scary. Right? Because the fly in the ointment is, this kingdom must reflect God's character. The fly in the ointment is that the church must reflect God's character. For this to work as a proper litmus test. But let's not go there just now. Okay. If you notice, well, I say Genesis 12, 1 through 3 is the kind of lays the programmatic overview of the Old Testament, because it is. If you want to think about the building of God's kingdom laid out in verse 1, 2, 3, you see that the rest of the Old Testament actually is organized along those terms. We identify four basic elements you need for a kingdom. You need people. You need a set of common culture law that tells us people how to live according to God's ways. You need land so they can actually live there. And then ultimately you need some kind of a king for a kingdom to work. That the rest of the Old Testament primary history is organized people, law, land, king. So So you start with the peoples, Genesis 12 through 50, you have the patriarchs of the kingdom. You have these the people who are putting their DNA into the peoples. And you find out what does it mean to be God's people in these stories. And then you have the delivering of the people out of slavery for the kingdom in Exodus 1 through 19. And this is kind of the people section. And then we get the constitution, the law section, going all the way to Deuteronomy. We have land in Joshua. We have the failure of the people. Without proper leadership, they fail in the book of Judges. And then we have the gift of kingship and the failure of the kings in 1 Samuel to 2 Kings. And for goodness sake, it's about the kings. Right? It's about kings. So that's the rest of primary history. I just want to know that the idea of Abraham being called to be a blessing to the nation is heavily emphasized in Genesis. And this is where it shows up again and again. Okay, Abraham become a great nation. I want to read this. You can read this on your own. We don't have a lot of time. It shows up again and again. And it shows up also in the law section in Genesis, Exodus 19. This is kind of the final part of the people section. And we have this great passage in which God telling his people, this is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and you are to tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be of my treasure possession. Okay. And though the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The idea of priest was mediation. So to mediate God to others, the whole Israel is to be a priest for the rest of the world to understand God and learn about God. This idea of the people having that mediatory role to the world is right here. Right? This is right before they signed the covenant. Okay, Exodus 20, Ten Commandments, show right up. How are you going to be this holy nation? Here are the commandments. Here are the laws that explains who I am as God. Live this out. Be the priest to the world. Okay. Now, you will notice that as you leave the law sections. We have a couple more passages about this and about other people. Once you get into Joshua and the rest, the idea of, in the primary history at least, the idea of blessing to the nations falls out. It just kind of drops out. Okay. And you might wonder why that is. This important theme right at the beginning in Genesis 12, at the end, it's not mentioned at all. I think it's pretty obvious why. The failure. At some point, the storyline focuses on Israel's attempt to stay faithful. It's so worried about itself, its ability to stay in covenant with God, that the storyline has nothing to do about doing anything with the nations. It's just trying to survive. So you will find much more of this in the prophets and the Psalms. Okay? Not in primary history anymore. Okay. So, any questions on these two pivotal passages? We're going to move on a little bit.
Okay. Quick question. Sorry. How much time between 11 and 12? Do we know?
No.
Okay, thanks.
Not a clue.
Not
according to Genesis 10, because the story is dischronologized, Genesis 10, they show quite a bit of generations. But even then, the question is, are these generations intended to be absolute, or they just signify other things? So yeah, if you look at Genesis 10, you will see there's a point. Genesis 10, in the family history, you will see the place where language is changed. And then after that, how many generations to Abram? So if you want to count those generations, you could try that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Sure.
Yes?
How necessary is the historicity of Genesis 11
yeah.
to what you're saying? If it's a parable or a story or something other than history, I've often heard history really starts with Genesis 12 and everything prior to that is kind of up for grabs. With what you're saying, how important is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me hold off on the historicity question because I think that's going to take us off. But I would say that narratively speaking, it's critical. Right? Even if you step away and say, oh, I don't know about the history of Genesis 11, within the storyline itself, its connection to 12 is unmistakable, and it serving as kind of the culmination of the problem of the world in which the kingdom of God is a response to, that is unmistakable. So, yeah. But we can talk about the history if we have time. Okay. I find this helpful. I mean, it's just me. I find these kind of schematics helpful for me to understand what's going on in the story. In Genesis 11, it's kind of interesting what's going on. The one people, they want to make a name for themselves in order to stay together. So they have a final goal, and they have a way of achieving it, which is by making a name. And the way to do that, the way to build reputation, say we're divinely sanctioned so we can stay together, well, we use God. So God in the form of a religious, architecturally beautiful tower. That looks really beautiful. We're going to use that tower to accomplish what we're looking for. And of course, God shows up. So the agent that's being used in the story decides to not cooperate. Okay. So there's a storyline right here. God wants to, somebody wants to do something. They use something else. That something else doesn't cooperate. And it says, well, actually, I don't want you to stay together. I want to make you into many people. So that what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide your language. Okay. So we have this additional thing. The thing that's being used objects to being used. That's going to show up in the rest of the Old Testament as well, because God comes along and creates something. He wants to use something to achieve an end. And he creates Israel, blesses Israel, makes name for it, and he says, I'm going to use you to bless the nations. Okay. And we know what happens there. Okay. Now the question here is, how does that work? How does Israel bless the nations? What form does it take in the Old Testament? Well, in Deuteronomy, we have passages like this. Observe them, that's the laws, carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this is a great nation, it's wise and understanding people. What other nation is so great as to have their gods near them the way Yahweh our God is near us whenever we pray to Him? And what other nation is so great as to have such righteous decrees and laws as this body of laws I am setting before you today? Deuteronomy 28. Yahweh will establish you as His holy people. As He promised you on oath, if you keep the commandments of Yahweh your God and walk in obedience to Him, then all the peoples on earth will see that you are called by the name of Yahweh and they will fear you. I think it's pretty clear that in the Old Testament what the plan was. You have this law, these set of laws, you live that out in your society, and other people are saying, what an amazing society. What an amazing nation. Look at that. And they will fear it, they will think this. They are truly divine. So if you want to think about it this way, there is whereas the Babylonians were building towers to show divine sanction, God says, no, the divine sanction is shown through an ethical society built around solid laws, righteous laws. That's how you show divine sanction. That's how you show that God is with you. Okay? So that's kind of the shift here. So, you know, God didn't ask for a temple to get built. Maybe it's kind of a little reaction to Babylon. I mean, later on, you know, David wants to build a temple. Sure, he consents to have it built. But it wasn't his drive. Because he's not doing the whole Babylonian thing. The Babylonian thing was, look at that. That's God's divine sanction. God says, no, divine sanction is about the laws. Okay, God bless Israel because Israel has the right laws. Okay, so one of the ways in which the nations come to Israel is that they fear this country, a nation, they respect it. And other ways, so here's another one, in Isaiah. So we're talking about leaving out a primary history. In the last days, the mountain of Yahweh's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the temple of God of Jacob. He will teach us His ways, and we may walk in His paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations, will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares, and the rest you know. One of the most famous passages of the Old Testament. So the idea is that Israel will be kind of at this height, and other nations will respect it and will see it, and they will come to it, and they will respect its judgments. There's kind of an implicit authority here. It seems very voluntary. People are just coming because it's so wonderful. Psalm 2 is a little different. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. Yahweh scoffs at them. He rebukes them in His anger and terrifies them in His wrath, saying, I've installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. And then the king speaks, I will proclaim Yahweh's decree, you are my son, today I have become your father. Ask me, I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. So in the Isaiah passage, we have people flowing to Jerusalem in kind of in obedience and learning of wisdom. And in Psalm 2, we have Yahweh's appointed Messiah is going, you know, we're gonna do some, you know, Gentile butt kicking, and I mean, you know, just kind of how it goes. And we have different visions of this, how this is gonna work. Some kind of way in which Israel is above the nations, okay, whether in power or just pure moral authority. Okay, running out of time, I'm gonna skip this one. So, blessing a nation in the Old Testament, ruling the nation through Israel or through Israel's king, maybe. And we also have another example of the Old Testament, which is the book of Ruth, which deals with a Gentile woman who comes into Israel and becomes so totally Jewish, she becomes the ancestor of David. Okay. Kind of this, and she and Rahab would be another example. We have these women who come into the storyline. We have people come into the storyline, we also have Isaiah, in which foreigners come into the kingdom and become enculturated as Jews. So I would really say this. At the end of the Old Testament, if you want to talk about Israel being a blessing to the nations, which of course you can anyway, Israel's fallen apart, but what was the original vision? Something about ruling, a king ruling the world, and something about people joining it and becoming enculturated as Jews. Those, I think, are the two options that are available in the Old Testament. Of course, you know the story. This is what God wanted to do, and Israel said, no, thank you. We want to become one of the nations. Okay? We don't really want to be the special. We don't like being the special role. We want to move on. They don't want the job. So as a result, God scatters them among the nations. You want to be one of them? Go be one of them. And you'll notice this idea of scattering showing up at the end of Genesis 3 when they've moved out of Eden, end of Genesis 11 when the people are scattering, and then we have another scattering. Because it's this repeated scattering in the Old Testament. Okay. So, the one cannot become many.
Did you say the one cannot become many?
You cannot become the many.
Cannot.
The idea is that the many become the one cannot become the many. You cannot go the other way. That's one thing you cannot do. Okay, the one thing you cannot do. The New Testament, and I don't have a lot of time to do this, we have a new Israel reconstituted in Christ called the church, and with individuals from all nations. Okay, so we, in a sense, you still have the king of Israel, Jesus, ruling over the nations. But we have the nations joining in, right? The nations joining in. And so is this kind of the Ruth option? And I would say, here's what's interesting about the New Testament. The big question in the New Testament is, on what terms do Gentiles join Israel? Right? That's the big debate. And we saw some of that in Acts 6, in which the power is moving out of the Hebraists into the Hellenists, and then moving on forward, eventually to the Gentiles, and which culminates in, you know, the Gentile church taking over. What are the terms? And within the Christians, there were this debate about this. Do they have to become Jewish or not? Okay. So the big questions in Romans, Galatians, in Corinthians, over and over again, this question. And the New Testament authors come down decisively on one side, which is they don't have to be Jews. They come in on their own terms. They come in retaining their culture, retaining their language. And they're coming in without being uniform. So, we go to the pivotal passage of the church. This is the story that comes when Jesus have died and resurrected and ascended into heaven, and the disciples are sitting there waiting for the coming of the Holy Spirit. This is the beginning story, and I would say when you have stories at the beginning of the church, it is encapsulated what the church is about. Okay, these are pivotal passages. Okay, so grab this one. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation, under heaven, and at this sound the multitude came together, so the coming together of every nation. Okay. And they were bewildered because each one heard them speaking his own language. So you have the church here being developed, and the nations are coming to it, And there each one heard them speaking his own language, and they were amazed and wondered and said, saying, are not all these people speaking Galileans? And how is it that they, how we hear each of us in his own native language? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia. I'm going to keep going, skip down, okay? And both Jews and Apostolites, Cretans and Arabians, we hear them telling in our own tongues the mighty works of God. Now, many, many people recognize that this is an echo to Tower of Babel, Babylon. It is, and people call this a reversal of the Tower of Babylon. Okay. Now, I want to note once again, it isn't quite a reversal. Okay, it's not a reversal. The Tower of Babylon, God separated them by changing their language. Here, God did not unify the languages. Okay. Understand, this passage is what the church is about. Okay, so listen carefully. God said, I'm going to help you guys become unified while maintaining your language distinctives. Here's the church now. You have nations scattered and broken, and I'm going to connect you all. You will all understand. The Spirit has come to unite you while maintaining language distinctives. I'm going to do what the Tower of Babylon can't do. The Babylonians can't do. The Babylonian says we can unite if we're the same. The church says we can unite being different. We're going to show you how love is done properly. The church is called to be this different community that is not based on uniformity. Well, our love is based on the fact that we're different, not based on the fact that we're the same. And the world can't do it. Okay? They're in Tower of Babel. They can't pull it off at all. The church is called into this ministry right from the very beginning. Right from the very beginning. Hence Acts 6. Hence Acts 15. Okay? And hence the story ends at Rome. We've been in the business of reconciling people of different language and ethnicity and culture from the very get-go of the church. That's what it's about. I'll end with this one. My prayer is not for them alone, like Jesus' prayer. I also pray for those who will believe in me through their message. So them is the disciples right here that Jesus is praying for. That all may be one. Father, just as you are in me, I am in you. The oneness of the Trinity, the disciples are participating. May they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity, that the world will know that you sent me and have loved me, love them even as you have loved me. God is bringing together all things, reconciling all things into himself, and it is this oneness that shows the world that God divine sanction. We can do what people can't do at Tower of Babel. That makes us different. They use a tower to tell them God loves them. Our love for each other, because of our differences, tells us God is present. Tells the world that God is present. That's the role multi-ethnicity plays in the story arc. Questions? Rich.
I've been trying to place multi-ethnicity. I don't want to get you in trouble.
Okay.
Kind of wondering, is it a byproduct or is it a major goal?
Right. So I would say, if you look at the pivotal passage of the storyline, if you look at Genesis 11, which is a summary of the world, it's about multi-ethnicity. If you look at Genesis 12, the passage of the entire rest of the Bible, the starting point. If you look at Acts. If you look at Acts 2, the starting point of the church about unifying the nations and creating communication, the pivotal passages are all dealing with this central issue. And in a way, it's saying, this is the solution to the Tower of Babel. So I would say, from a biblical theology perspective, I would put it front and center. This is what the church is about. This is how we love. Other people love too. That's no big deal. I think Jesus made that point, right? You love your friends. We all love each other. Do not the pagans even do that? Love is not a big deal. Forgiveness. People forgive. It's been done. Okay? So what the world needs is a love that will transcend differences. If you look at what's going on in the world today, that's the problem, the biggest one. And the kingdom of God is to be defined by the ability to unite people who are different and to show that to the world. And frankly, our failure in this, let's stop there. But does that answer your question? I'm saying this is really in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay? Because the pivotal passage I'll deal with this. Right. And I would say redemption is... Right. Maybe we can talk about that later.
Okay.
There.
Yeah, and even at the end of the Bible, Revelation 21, you've got the kings of the earth bringing the glory into the city. So
yeah.
There's still differences, but they're all coming to the same place.
So if you from a biblical narrative arc perspective, it is... In all the pivotal passages, it's showing up. Like, this is the theme of the Bible. Now, if you want to say, okay, I want to talk about redemption, I want to talk about other things, I don't know how you weigh a theological, you know, what's more important than other. I'm on the biblical side. I'm not much of a systematic theologian. So I lean toward the narrative. And the narrative is telling me this is critical. Okay? The way the story is told is telling me this is what it's all about. So...
So it's a beautiful thing in terms of ground zero, what happens at ground zero.
Yeah.
But even within the history of the New Testament, when we see how Paul deals with his churches, that sort of thing, presumably this isn't still going on.
No.
They are segregating.
Yes,
by language.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes.
And so, can you say something to that?
That's a great question. So here we have, I would call these kind of like inactive parables, or not parables, inactive metaphors. Okay, so here's a story where God acts out something that is supposed to be symbolic of what the church does as a whole. Performance art, if you want. Okay, this is some kind of a performance art that the Holy Spirit does to help you go, oh, that's what the church is about. And after that, it goes away, and now you have the hard work. Right? So the Hebraeans and Hellenists split up, and there's problems already, right from the top. Right? So by no means is this supposed to be simple, or is this automatic. But this gives us the programmatic goal of the church. The question is, then, how do you actually get these people to sit together? So the Galatians 2, different difficulty. Here are the Jews. Eating with Gentiles is unclean. You guys are Gentiles. Okay, I'm going to accept you as brothers in Christ. It would mean that I disown my Jewish identity. That's a huge problem. Right? So how do you work that out? Right? But what's not allowed is you guys remain separate. That's what's not allowed. Right, that's one thing that Paul said. No way, you are one people. Sit together, okay? So now we've decided not to do that. We say we can do church. We can separate all we want now, and it's easy to find churches that suit us and who look just like us. But I would say that's not the New Testament vision. That in the ways in which we have not sought out different groups of people and create unified churches with them, that is our failure.
You realize you've just handed a very major critique of the whole idea of the